cool. I was born in Seattle, Washington. Grew up in an area called the Central District. It's a predominantly black area, or, you know, late 80s, early 90s. Now it's completely gentrified, so it's, I think it's even called something different now. But yeah, that's the area I grew up in.
Isaac Porter is a musician and a producer. He's also the guy Emmanuel Fair calls his oldest friend. Their relationship started almost 3 decades ago on a very hilly block in the Central District. Isaac lived uphill and Emmanuel lived downhill, adjoining backyards. Both of them had basketball hoops.
So we like dug a tunnel between the blackberry bushes to get to each other's hoops. And that's how we became friends, like as super young kids.
Isaac and Emmanuel were inseparable as kids. Isaac's parents weren't together, but his mom's house was stable and safe, and Emmanuel liked to spend time there. Emmanuel, in turn, was there for Isaac, a skinny, biracial skater who'd never exactly fit in with any group in the neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, he would step up and look out for me sometimes when people would, like, be curious about, like, why I was around or who I was, and, you know, he would always, like, step up for me. That's how I knew he was, like, different, because he'd be like, yo, leave dude alone, that's my guy, that type of stuff. So he was like the gentle giant, you know what I mean?
Isaac knew Emmanuel's family life was rough. His mom was an addict, and so his grandmother had taken him in. She told Emmanuel's mom not to visit, but his mom had to come see her son. She'd stand on the porch and whisper through the mail slot to him. Sometimes Emmanuel would find her sleeping there when he opened the door in the morning to go to school. She died when Emmanuel was still in his teens, shortly after being released from a jail in Tacoma. At the age of 14, Emmanuel's family decided it would be better if he moved in with his mother's oldest sister and her husband. He left his grandmother's house, which meant he no longer shared a backyard with Isaac. But Emmanuel's aunt and uncle were strict and devoutly religious, and Emmanuel had become used to taking care of himself. He chafed at all their rules. And after less than 2 years, he decided to run away, eventually ending up in a foster home.
It was pretty bad. Yeah, that's why I give Emmanuel a lot of credit for still being like a positive person. Like, he's just been through so much shit. I give him a lot of credit for just not choosing to be like, fuck it.
As a teenager, and then as a young adult, Isaac tried to be there for his friend the same way he'd been there when they were kids. He gave Emmanuel opportunities to help produce his group's music, and he found him work at his mom's t-shirt shop. And when Emmanuel was released from prison in 2006, after serving almost 3 years for the rape charge, Isaac suggested his friend come live with him.
I just seen he was really not operating at the best frequency that I knew he was capable of. So I was just like, bro, just get off the streets and just come live with me and my mom for a while and like try to get your head straight.
So Emmanuel moved in with Isaac and stayed with him on and off. It was Isaac's house that he called home in the fall of 2008 when, one weekend, while Isaac was visiting friends in California, Emmanuel set out for Redmond to attend the party at the Valley View.
I had no clue he was going to do that until he called me and told me, I'm at a party. It's a Halloween party. I'm like, whose party? And he just explained to me that it was like a joint shared apartment type of party that one of his friends who had an apartment in the complex was part of.
On Monday, November 3rd, a few hours after police had found Arpana Janaga's body, Emmanuel got in touch with Isaac again.
He did call me and said, yo, like, I just woke up and there's, like, some shit popping off at this complex. I do remember that.
That call set off alarm bells for Isaac.
One of the first things I thought was that I hope they don't try to, like, blame this on him because he has a record, he's black, and he has gang history.
For a couple of weeks, Isaac's worries seemed unfounded. The police didn't even contact Emmanuel. The party wasn't a topic of conversation between the two friends. Life was normal. But as the investigation into the murder of Arpana Janaga progressed into the new year, that began to change. After months of quiet, police decided they were interested in Emmanuel, so much so that they executed a warrant on Isaac's mom's place in the Central District.
They searched the basement where Emmanuel had been staying, went through his clothes, his boxes and stuff. You know, took shit. I remember being like, they're taking a lot of stuff that all has his DNA on it, you know? I ain't gonna start asking questions. I'm just like, okay.
But the detectives did ask questions about Emmanuel. They asked what he'd said after Arpana's body had been discovered. And that conversation with the cops, it was like all of Isaac's fears were coming true.
I was like, yo, it seems like they're already trying to pin this on him. I mean, it just felt like they assumed he was guilty and they needed to find evidence to prove it.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like, every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From Campside Media and Wondery, I'm Matthew Scherr, and this is Suspect. This is episode 5, The Break.
Tonight, an update on a murder mystery in Redmond. Last November, 24-year-old Arpana Janega was found strangled in her normally quiet and safe neighborhood. Redmond police say her murder is still an active case, and they are working hard to solve it. For Redmond police, this case is their top priority, and they say they do have persons of interest. They've sent DNA evidence off to be analyzed and say they are confident this murder will be solved.
After investigators had photographed and diagrammed the crime scene at the Valley View Apartments, and after the victim's body had been removed, police went through Arpana's unit. They bagged evidence, her comforter, a brown bath towel, some beer bottles, a slice of pizza, anything that might help them find the killer. Investigators also combed through the dumpster behind the complex, where they found a set of Arpana's sheets and her bathrobe. And they found a plastic shopping bag containing a bottle of Castrol Syntac motor oil and a bootlace. All of this evidence was boxed up and sent to the Washington State Patrol Crime Lab into the care of Breanne Huseby. Breanne was a senior forensic analyst, the lead on the Janega case. It would be her job to process the evidence from the crime scene and to isolate the DNA profiles that might help detectives and prosecutors crack the case.
Well, I mean, ultimately, the main thing DNA tells you is who. It has a very high discrimination power. We can always identify an individual if there's enough DNA present.
Breanne knew that if wasn't going to be a problem here. The truth was, in this case, there was almost too much DNA from the crime scene.
You know, going into examining the evidence, I knew that it would be more difficult than a lot of cases. You know, a lot of cases, the crime happens and the people leave, but that obviously did not happen in this case.
Party attendees had traipsed in and out of Arpana's unit at the Valley View on the night of her murder, shedding skin cells behind them, marking the surfaces with their fingerprints. And not only that, there was also evidence of a cover-up. Bleach had been poured around the apartment, and motor oil doused over the lower half of Arpana's body. There was acidic toilet bowl cleaner on her fingertips, and an attempt by someone to light the crime scene on fire. One of the first things Breanne did was conduct a rape kit on Arpana, which came back negative. That didn't necessarily mean Arpana hadn't been raped. But to Breanne, the pattern of bruising, the fact that Arpana's tampon had been removed, suggested there was undoubtedly a sexual component to the crime. Perhaps the killer had cleaned the victim of evidence as sexual assault the same way he had attempted to clean the crime scene. Either way, the kit was negative for traces of foreign DNA. Same story with the wadded up, half-burned paper towels that had been found near the body. Nothing. Brianne was getting frustrated. There had to be usable DNA somewhere. Her break arrived in late January of 2009, when Brianne turned to two objects that investigators believed were directly linked to the crime. Objects that would, finally, yield some answers. The first was the bottle of motor oil. Brianne was able to ascertain that the bottle matched the type of motor oil poured over Arpana's body. And she found a fair amount of DNA on the exterior of the bottle. The DNA of Cameron Johnson, the police's lead suspect at the time.
It's not consistent with just picking up and setting it down. It's consistent with either a more significant handling, you know, if the motor oil bottle was sitting on the counter at the party and he sneezed on it, you know, that amount of DNA could be consistent with that.
But no one police interviewed could remember Cameron handling the bottle. In fact, no photos from the evening showed the bottle in Arpana's apartment. When Brianne talks about evidence like the motor oil bottle, she uses the word probative. Probative means it's evidence that can prove the case, that can allow a prosecutor to get up in a courtroom and point so convincingly towards a defendant that the jury is left without reasonable doubt. But there was a second object that complicated the picture, the red robe Arpana likely wore shortly before her death.
It was clearly tied to the actual incident. There was bloodstains along both of the lapels of the front of the robe. The ties to the robe were separated from it, so it looked like they were originally, you know, one tie maybe on each hip, and they had come off the robe. So at that point, it would no longer be of use to the person that just wants to use the robe on a daily basis. So I think that that probably occurred during the struggle.
Brianne started by testing the bloodstains for DNA. Arpana's DNA was on there, naturally, but so was a man's. So Brianne ran that profile against samples collected from partygoers and residents of the Valley View and got a match.
I went through, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There were 5 other reference samples that I also compared and excluded. And then when I got to Emmanuel Fair, I was not able to exclude him.
This DNA match on the robe fundamentally altered the course of the case. It undercut the conclusion the investigators might be tempted to reach from the DNA on the motor oil bottle, and it changed everything for Emmanuel. Prior to January of 2009, he had been a person of interest, more compelling to police because of his criminal record than anything else. But now, Brianne had produced an analysis that showed a direct link between Emmanuel Fair and the murder victim. And then, Brianne found more.
The next report I issued on April 3rd, 2009, and it was actually a fairly short one because I found another piece of evidence that was, this one is actually probably the most interesting evidence in this case, as well as probably my most interesting piece of evidence I've ever looked at because of the story it told. It was the black duct tape roll.
This duct tape roll had been found on Arpana's sofa. Originally, none of the investigators thought it was going to be of much help. They figured Arpana had probably used it to hang up some Halloween decorations. But Brianne was the one who took a closer look.
There was a significant amount of hair, long black hair, attached to it. There was also some little brown threads and some little stretches of clear elastic that, you know, if you're a girl, you would know looks like elastic from inside of lace underwear. So it was kind of strange that this duct tape has hair and threads and elastic. However, this, in my mind, drew me to another piece of evidence that we had, which was a pair of brown lace underpants that were found sitting on top of a piece of pizza in the kitchen right by the door. That underwear had saliva on it, it had blood on it, and it had only Miss Janaga's DNA.
Brianne wondered if there was other DNA on the tape. If the duct tape had been used to secure the underwear as a gag, it made sense that the killer would have been the last person to pull it. And the end of the tape did contain a small amount of DNA that matched one of the men at the party, Emmanuel Fair.
The amount of DNA on the end of that tape really is consistent with someone touching the end of that tape. And that tape had her hair in it. It had pieces of her underwear in it. That tape was linked to her death. So finding that DNA profile on the end of the tape is not something that you can really overlook.
The King County Courthouse is in downtown Seattle, in a 10-story tower near Pioneer Square, across the street from the jail. On the top floor, there's a windowless sky bridge, which bailiffs use to escort prisoners to and from hearings. Every weekday, there are motions to be heard, bench or jury trials to be set. Six floors down from the sky bridge are the offices of the King County Prosecuting Attorney, the group responsible for representing the state in every criminal case in the Seattle metro area.
So to sort of situate people and how the office works, how many prosecutors are there in this office?
So, right, we have the elected prosecutor, who is Dan Satterberg, and then there is a criminal division, a civil division, and a family support division. So the criminal division has about 170 lawyers that work just on criminal cases.
It's a big office.
Yes.
At the time of the Janaga case, Erin Ellert was one of the most senior prosecutors in King County. Last year, she agreed to sit for an hour-long interview, providing she and her press aide could tape me with their own recorder. They didn't want anything misconstrued or taken out of context. By the way, Erin's wearing a mask. That's why her voice sounds a little muffled.
I have done most of the different subjects in the office. I prosecuted domestic violence, sexual assault, just regular felony trials, and then homicides. And then for about the next 7 or 8 years or 10 years, I can't recall, I was the assistant chief of the criminal division, so I was in more of a leadership role, but I maintained homicide cases at that time.
So Erin had worked a lot of murders. But the murder of Arpana Janaga still stood out.
It's not that often that we have no witnesses. The person who had the crime committed against them is deceased. And so you are truly putting it together with a combination of circumstantial evidence and DNA forensic evidence. A true whodunit, I guess, in other words, it's just not that common anymore.
What did you think when you first started reviewing the documents? You must have looked at it and thought, man, I got my work cut out for me.
We recognized it would be solved through forensics. And I like the DNA cases. I had no idea it was going to end up the way it did in this case.
Erin had kept track of the investigation from the time the body was discovered. At first, she'd been as uncertain as the police about who did it. But the two reports from Breanne Hughesby at the State Police Crime Lab about the DNA on the robe, and the one about the DNA on the duct tape, put everything in a different light. Because Erin Ellert saw what Breanne had seen, a window into Arpana Janaga's last moments.
We know that she had been gagged at some point in time during this ordeal that she suffered through. We know that because her underwear had been shoved in her mouth. Underwear was her underwear. It had her saliva on it. And the duct tape had been wrapped around her head.
Erin and her colleagues at the prosecutor's office threw around some possible scenarios. What if an intruder barged in? What if it was someone Arpana knew, someone she said no to, which led to him getting violent?
Is it fair to say that whoever did this was really, really angry?
Well, I'm not sure we'll ever know, right? I mean, were they angry? Was this something that they enjoyed, that this is what they do? Perhaps she resisted and they didn't like that. I don't know, anger is a hard emotion because I think that people say, well, if you're attracted to someone, you would never do this. But we also know that people that are attracted to people commit all kinds of crimes. And so, you know, fortunately, we never have to prove the emotion that someone had at the time they commit these crimes. I think they can be quite complex.
The big problem for Aaron was that although the evidence pointing to Emmanuel seemed compelling, so did the evidence pointing at Cameron Johnson. Emmanuel's DNA was on the robe and tape and on bloody toilet paper found in the bathroom, which could have been from Emmanuel getting jabbed in the lip by Neil Marshall. But Cameron Johnson's DNA was on the motor oil bottle, which investigators believed was closely connected to the crime.
Was there ever a time when you came close to charging Cameron?
I think so. I mean, I think we thought about it all along. The difficulty with Cameron, I don't know what other people who know this case would say, but I think even to this day, I have the question of whether he was involved in some way. Did he come upon, did he hear what was going on? Did he go in the apartment? But that's the cleanup, right? Just because someone may have been present afterwards doesn't mean I can prove that they killed the person.
Unfortunately, as more evidence was processed by the State Police Crime Lab through 2009, things actually became murkier. For example, Breanne found male DNA profiles on a bruise on Arpana's wrist and on the string of Arpana's tampon. These profiles did not match Emmanuel Fair or Cameron Johnson or anyone else who had given police DNA samples in the case. Was it possible that the killer was someone the cops didn't yet know about? Truth is, we may never know, because all that other evidence and the directions it might point do not appear to have altered the course of the investigation through 2009 and early 2010. The investigation was increasingly narrowing in scope around a very small number of suspects. Two, in fact, Emmanuel Fair and Cameron Johnson.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
This is your last chance to save 65% on a full year of BODi. I'm Carl, co-founder of BODi. That's B-O-D-I. And I want to help you lean into your decision to start working out and eating better. Right now, if you sign up for a one-year subscription to BODi, I'll give you 65% off. Look, I know it's not easy to get fit and lose weight, especially if you're trying to figure it out by yourself. But we make it simple. Just follow a program for 20 to 30 minutes day by day and lose 5 to 10 pounds a month. We have over 120 programs that have been tested and proven to work, and almost 300,000 five-star reviews in the App Store to prove it. BODi also has complete eating plans and thousands of healthy, delicious recipes. So stop guessing and start seeing results with BODi. And let me give you 65% off right now so you save big on the app that CNN underscored named Best Fitness App. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of BODi and save 65%. Just go to BODi.com. That's B-O-D-I with an I.com.
In September of 2009, Brian Coates sat down in a room at the jail for his third interrogation of Emmanuel Fair. Coates explained that his intention was, quote, to take the case to the prosecutor, recommend that they charge Cameron with murder. Coates said to Emmanuel he was recommending, quote, charging you with murder as well. So Cameron and Emmanuel, even though the only evidence police and prosecutors had of a murder conspiracy is that the two men, strangers before the night of that party, had listened to music together for about 30 minutes. Coates' comments to Emmanuel weren't a bluff exactly. He still thinks both men were involved with the crime, even to this day. But they were hyperbole. Coates knew the Redmond PD still needed more evidence before it could charge anyone with murder. Ideally, what Coates needed was a confession. Barring a confession, he needed a new witness, a new piece of evidence. Something, anything, to break the case. Which is why, in late January of 2010, the Redmond Police Department made the decision to reach out to a, well,
let's just call it an unconventional consultant.
Now, you had to bring that up. Let's say when a boss tells me to do something, I do it. But yeah, there was a medium in town, Alison Dubois, I think was her name. Maybe even was, they might have a show that was kind of around what she does for a living. So I was kind of instructed to send her some photos and see what she had to say. But I didn't take it seriously and looked at it, evaluated it, is what it is.
If Alison Dubois' name sounds familiar, it may be because you once saw an episode of the TV show Medium, in which Patricia Arquette plays a character inspired by the real Alison, a crime-solving law enforcement consultant.
My name's Alison Dubois. I see the deceased. They seem to seek me out.
Even among the special, you're special.
I'm just a girl who wants to be a lawyer.
We're pretty curious about what exactly Alison the medium had done for the Redmond PD, so we submitted a public records request for any and all emails between Dubois and Brian Coates and his colleagues. Within a couple of weeks, a raft of emails had arrived in our inboxes. Coates tells Dubois that there are, quote, two likely suspects involved in this case. He asks for help in locating Arpana's phone and digital camera. He also wonders if there is, quote, a witness out there whom detectives haven't spoken to yet. Someone who can help them break the impasse. Dubois' replies arrived over a period of days as she attempted to make contact with Arpana from the beyond. She thought there was a chubby white girl who was hiding something. There are mentions of street racing. As for the whereabouts of Arpana's phone or camera, Dubois never came back with a good answer on that. It's not clear what police did with the information Dubois offered. The emails between the medium and the Redmond PD trail off as Dubois' replies keep getting wider and wider from any sort of usable mark. Then they stop altogether. In May of 2010, police interviewed Cameron Johnson, who, unlike Emmanuel, had his lawyers present. The police agreed to give Cameron immunity for the interview, meaning nothing he said then could be used against him later. I should say, that arrangement is far more common for a witness in a trial than a potential defendant. Two months later, in July, a new piece of DNA evidence came in. The evidence centered on a swab Breanne Hughesby had taken from Arpana Janaga's neck. Since the medical examiner had concluded Arpana had died from strangulation, foreign DNA on Arpana's neck could be something close to a smoking gun. Breanne had concluded there was a male DNA profile on the swab, but it was in such a small quantity, her lab equipment wasn't sensitive enough to test it. So the state crime lab outsourced the testing to a private company, and that company did find a DNA match to Emmanuel Fair.
Committed to complete Northwest news coverage, Cairo 7 Eyewitness News starts right now.
It's been 2 years since the brutal murder of a young Redmond woman after a Halloween party.
And tonight, police say they finally got their man. Arpana Janaga was just 24 years old, and friends say she was a brilliant software engineer. In 2008, she went to a Halloween party at her apartment complex, where she was spotted by this man, 27-year-old Emmanuel Fair, a man she didn't...
The same day media around Seattle began broadcasting news of the charges against Emmanuel, Barbara Tripp was in her car when she felt her phone start to ring. The number was one she didn't recognize.
Hello? I have a prepaid call from an inmate at Washington Correction Center. Please accept this call for 5 now. If you just...
Hello?
Hey.
What's up, man?
What's going on?
This motherfucker got me a shot in that shit, man.
Barbara had known Emmanuel for years. They'd met when Emmanuel was locked up for third-degree rape. They'd become pen pals, fallen briefly in love, then settled into a lasting friendship. She and Emmanuel were tight, or at least she thought they were. How had Emmanuel failed to tell her that he was now arrested in a facility in Shelton, about 90 minutes from Seattle, where apparently he'd spent days in solitary confinement? What was happening?
You don't know why you're there?
No. And I don't know anything. I'm just sitting here in this hole. You know what I'm saying?
You want me to tell you?
Is it about that stupid shit?
That you've been charged with murder for the 45 years to life or whatever?
Are you serious?
Yes, Emmanuel. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm sitting here trying to tell your family that.
Barbara felt dizzy. Emmanuel had barely ever talked about the party at the Valley View. She had no idea he was a suspect, much less the prime suspect in a murder. Her confusion turned to rage. Why was Emmanuel being so non-responsive?
I was like, what the fuck? I was like, what do you mean, what's going on? I was like, what's going on with you? I was like, who are all these people? I was like, what are you talking about? You murdered this girl. I was like, what girl? I was like, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm at Washington State Penitentiary. He's like, I don't know why I'm here. They just brought me here. And I was like, what do you mean? You know, I was like, how do you not know this stuff?
Barbara tried to level with him. Things are bad. Really, really bad.
You're all over the TV, dude.
What?
I said you're all over the TV.
All over the TV?
You're all over the internet, you're all over the TV, you're all over everything. Everything's all over the TV, yes. Have they talked to you?
So it was like, you're made out to be a monster. I was tripping. I was yelling at him. I was mad. I was in a parking lot at Bellingham. I had stepped out of the car, and I just let him have it because he hadn't called in a couple days.
On the phone from prison, Emmanuel tried to reassure his friend.
Hey, I did not do this shit.
Okay, well, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what to do. I don't know.
Barbara fought to get herself under control.
I don't know.
I was like, what's going on here? And, you know, I did have thoughts of, you know, you just don't know, you know what I mean? But I always, like, something told me, you know, like, I just didn't believe it.
Please don't cry. I'm trying to be strong.
Okay?
I need to get a lawyer or something, man.
You do. You're gonna have to, so I don't know. Shh, you need a fucking lawyer.
And I need to get a good one, because these motherfuckers are just gonna try to railroad a motherfucker, man.
That's on the next episode of Suspect.
They don't want you out. Ever.
Trying not to break down. This
shit's
crazy, babe.
I know. I'm sorry. I don't know how I can help you right now. I'm just praying for you, and I love you.
I love you, too. I don't want you to break down. Everything's going to be all right. I'm going to get a lawyer, figure out how I can get a lawyer. No.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Suspect ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Campside and Wondery, this is episode 5 of 9 of Suspect. Suspect was reported by Eric Benson, Natalia Winkleman, and me, Matthew Scher. Eric and I are producers. David Waters is the executive producer. Our editor is Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Field production by Kyle Norris. Aaliyah Papes and Callie Hitchcock are assistant producers. Fact-checking by Matthew Giles. Original music by Doug Slaywin and Netta Hadari. Consulting producers are Laura Ricciardi and Josie Duffy Rice. Our engineer is Jackie Sajiko. Mixing by Jackie Sajiko, Mark McAdam, and Garrett Tiedemann. Additional production assistance from Rod Sherwood. Studio engineer is Judd Caswell at Frog Hollow Studio in Topsom, Maine. At Campside, the executive producers are me, Vanessa Gregoriadis, Josh Dean, and Adam Hoff. For Wondery, Chris Siegel is the producer. Production assistance from Fiona Pastana. Managing producer is Lata Pandya. Executive producers are George Lavender, Marshall Louis, and Jen Sargent.
You're about to hear a preview of This Is Actually Happening. While you're listening, make sure to follow This Is Actually Happening on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or you can listen to new episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus and the Wondery app.
The one story that sticks with me the most from my time in Nicaragua was a young man they brought in. He was probably in his early 20s, who had had a leg blown off on a landmine. His lower leg had been completely blown off. He was alert and conscious, and so all of us congregated to take care of him. I'm arguing with the other docs about how many IVs we should start and how much pain medication we should give. And I gave him more than I would have otherwise, and that can drop your blood pressure, and decided that we were okay with just one IV, which is not trauma doctrine. Trauma doctrine is to put in two IVs in case you lose one. Just at that moment, the surgeon arrives, was told that there was a trauma. So we said, okay, great. We can take him to the operating room. We'll complete the amputation. And he looks like he's otherwise intact. So we take him to the OR. We're proceeding with the amputation and we lose his heartbeat. So to resuscitate him, we needed an IV. And of course, the one IV that I had said we were okay with failed. And so we needed an IV. But we got him back and the surgeon got another line. He had to do a cut down, but he did it. And we thought, oh, we're out of the woods. Patted ourselves on the back, got away with that one. Kid's going to be fine. Came back an hour later, and he was brain dead. And I blame myself ever after that I had given him too much medication that probably dropped his blood pressure, for not having given him the two IVs. What probably happened is the mine probably caused a bleed in his head that we didn't detect. But it was very impactful for me. I felt like a failure.
You just heard a preview of This Is Actually Happening. To listen to the rest of this episode, follow This Is Actually Happening wherever you get your podcasts.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.